Production. Recorded live.
Welcome, everybody. This is Jeff Roney, and you are listening to Roney Zone Radio, the most interesting talk show you've never heard of. So tonight we are going to be talking about something very interesting. But before that, I do want to give some introductory statements, and I do want to talk about the website. It is roneyzone.com. That's R-O-N, as in Nancy, E-Y-Z-O-N-E, Roneyzone. And that's where you'll find all of our great shows. We have RSS feeds for shows like Ear Giggles, Tatooine TV, Roneyzone Radio. There's the old Roneyzone radios that are there that will soon be moving over to TalkShoe. But anyway, all our content is there at roneyzone.com, and there's a lot of great things coming. Thank you, Mr. Dave. And also, we have some really exciting things coming, some audio dramas that I keep promising, and they are coming together, slow but sure. And but also, we have a very big multi-podcast host, multi-voice actor, huge old-time drama or old-time radio comedy drama that's coming. And that's all I'll say for that right now. So there's a lot of really great things coming. And so these shows that we do here, we're trying to do something different with each of these Roney Zone radios. We're trying to have a multi-topic show that's not the same thing all the time. If you know me for more than 5 minutes, you know I'm not the kind of person that can do a one-topic show. It's just impossible. So I need an open-ended show where I can talk about whatever I want to talk about. And I think thus far we've done a great thing, and we are continuing to try different things with the game shows and this and that and something else. So tonight we're going to be talking about music, and I'm going to ask for two more things, and then we're going to dive in. The first thing is, on our show page for Roney Zone Radio, it is talk.roneyzone.com. And it's hopefully the page, if you're logged in the computer, that's where you either found the show or that's where you're logged in at. If you could take a moment to leave some feedback on that page, if you look over to the right, kind of in the top area, you're going to see some purple little bubbles that are like the little voice and talking bubbles they use in cartoons. So you can choose 1 through 5, 5 being best, toward the plus sign. You can choose the rating of what you want to rate it, and then you can also, once you choose that, it'll say leave a full comment. Go ahead and click on that. Leave a comment. Be honest and leave some feedback, please, whether you are listening in the live show or whether you're downloading this later. Please go by talk.roneyzone.com and leave some feedback. I really appreciate it. If you like this show, if you don't like this show, if you want to hear something different, if you want to hear more of something that you've heard, please email roneyzone@gmail.com. So enough of the blistering amount of ads here. We are going to begin to talk about our subject tonight. The subject tonight is music. It's something that I love whole bunches. And as I just watch the news and read magazines and read newspapers and look around on the internet, there's all these changes in music. And the one thing I'm going to give you a little bit of sage advice before we even start is a good friend of mine told me, if you enjoy something, enjoy it now. Don't wait and don't say, well, maybe I'll go see that band later, or maybe I'll buy that record later, or maybe I'll whatever. If you like something, really enjoy it now. You never know how long it's going to be around. And as we talk about different types of music, different types of bands, musicians, singers, you know, some have died tragically, and that happens. Life just happens. But also bands break up. Types of music go away. What's really interesting is even with the movement from records to tapes and then to CDs and then to MP3, more electronic format, you're going to find that certain records are just impossible to find anymore. So, like I was saying before, if you like whatever type of music you like, find it in the most updated format you can. Try and keep your hands on it, because you never know when it's going to go away. There's bands that I've looked for now that I can't find. So, anyhow, that is my sage advice. So what we're going to do is I have everyone muted. If you have a comment, please let me know. You can either text, chat, and let me know. I will definitely unmute you. Not a problem. But I'm going to start here, because you just never know what's happening in the homes on the other side. So anyway, let me know, and I will unmute you. So we're going to be talking about the music business tonight. We're going to talk about music very much in general. We're going to start with the 50s. We're going to work through every decade, until we reach today. And the point is we're going to take a look at the different trends in music. Now, we can definitely wax poetic and, you know, talk about what we really like, really mention bands and really talk about what we like. But the key is, after we've done that, we really want to kind of highlight different trends. This type of music was big. This type of music, stood for a while. Maybe we have some overlaps. And that's going to be the interesting thing as we move forward. We're going to see, you know, there's reinvention of certain things. There's maybe reworking of certain types of music as we move forward. So we're going to start with the 50s. And as we start with the 50s, it really started off, as my wife reminds me, with the kind of overflow from the 40s. There were folks like Frank Sinatra that, you know, kind of carried over from that from that era. What was really interesting is that Frank Sinatra really had success in just about every decade, you know, that he was around. And so, you know, again, vocals and that style, you know, whether it was the Rat Pack in Vegas or whatever, there was that kind of vocal style. And did you have any comments, Mrs. Romy?
I'm sorry, what was that?
Well, we're talking about the 50s, and you mentioned that it was, some of it was an overflow from the 40s with Frank.
Yes, I didn't realize you wanted me to elaborate on that. But, yeah, Perry Como, Dean Martin, Frank Sinatra, they all were really, they really got their start in the 40s, and they sang with big bands. And as the decade kind of went on and music got a little more upbeat, not to say that the 40s didn't have upbeat music, because there were some definite swing bands that were very upbeat, but they were mostly the ratio of vocal to instrumental shifted quite a bit in the 50s. You didn't have nearly as many instrumental bands or music as you did in the 40s.
Mm-hmm.
But the carryover was that they carried sort of the similar style. They did a lot of crooning and sort of that thing in the 40s. That's what they were known for. And in the 50s, they kind of, it became what I would call now more like lounge singing.
Mm-hmm.
Not because it was bad, but because that's kind of what you would hear if you went to a nightclub back in the 50s. You know, you did have some instrumentals. You had, you know, bands like Xavier Cugat and a few others, but you really kind of saw a shift as music changed. There was still that kind of 1 foot in the 40s and 1 foot in the 50s as the decade kind of moved.
Well, yeah. I think one of the interesting things of the 50s was the emergence of Elvis. And to me, what was interesting about Elvis was that he, I'm not trying to jump too far ahead, but what is interesting to me is that he was very much a American Idol-ish type of a pop star, is that he didn't write songs. He didn't perform. He didn't play an instrument. He sang and he performed.
He played guitar, though. He did play guitar.
Okay. All right.
But that was not his forte. He wasn't a bad guitar player. He just really wasn't. He played more rhythm than anything else.
Okay.
You know, and he did play upon occasion in his songs. If you look at some of the old footage, he did play. So.
Right. But what I'm saying is he was performer first. He wasn't a musician first.
Correct.
And
correct.
So, I think what made him big was his charisma and his performance. That's really what made him big. And also his look. So,
yeah.
You're right. Dave said that none of the performers wrote their own music at that time. That really didn't start till the 60s. You're right. We'll leave it at that's right, and then we'll talk about something, a little bit. But, yes, Elvis kind of made the whole performing look, really big. However, he did not come by it first. There was another huge group of performers that really kind of came before, which was the Little Richard. That whole soul, R&B type of it just came like gangbusters. And unfortunately, at that time, America, sadly enough, was not ready for that type of music. Little Richard was big, but, Pat Boone had to soften it up for, the white audience at that point so that they could listen to the music and folks at that point, sadly enough, would feel more comfortable with listening from Pat Boone's mouth than Little Richard. But, that whole style of music just, came from the churches and that kind of movement, with the whole Little Richard, that really started to kind of change a lot of things. And Elvis took some of those cues and moved it out. And that the whole rhythm and blues and all that kind of stuff. So there was a lot of recreating of things going on at that point. But Elvis really kind of pops to the top of that list. But Little Richard holds his own. And then, of course, Chuck Berry as well. Now we start moving into guitar players and actual musicians. And then it really gets fun because, I think there is time for a performer, but I think there's also time for an actual innovator. And there's a lot of guitar players that look back to Chuck Berry and say he was the one. He was the one that got started. But as my wife pointed out, the 50s were not all Little Richard, Elvis, doo-wop, that kind of, vocal group or, Frank Sinatra. There was a whole other type of music coming out big at that point. What was that?
I'm sorry, say that again?
Okay. You're thinking country music, and you are absolutely right. Patsy Cline and this whole group of country musicians started to really come into their own in the 50s as well, which, again, was kind of an overlap from an earlier time. You had people like Patsy Cline, was it Flat and Scruggs and all that kind of stuff, just stuff they played and honky-tonks and all this kind of stuff. But with 50s music that was more musical, like a Patsy Cline, then you could play it on the radio. People were just, okay, let's see what we got here. Yeah. Okay. All right. Dave points out when we're talking about Little Richard that they were not ready for the performers, not the music, and that's true. As far as that whole Pat Boone, Little Richard, type of a thing. It was just, it was a sad time in America, to hold down a whole race of people, yeah, for whatever reason. But yeah, the R&B still holds true, and the country aspect, you know, came forward too. And then country also had a bit of its roots in church. And what's interesting is, if you look back, you know, everything I learned about life, I learned from Little House on the Prairie. I don't know about you, but I did. And one of the things is that the church was also the schoolhouse. And so there's certain things that kind of carried over between the two. And, you know, church music, they didn't have musicians in those days. It was probably just people that, you know, just kind of played on the front porch, you know, after they'd, you know, worked all day and whatever they did. And so that carried over onto radio. And so we've got R&B, which, you know, gave us Elvis, Pat Boone. We've got Patsy Cline and all this kind of stuff. And then we have Chuck Berry bringing in that type of, you know, great music. And again, you know, we've got Chuck Berry only able to play certain types of music. And I remember watching him in Hail, Hail, Rock and Roll. And he said, you know, he said, I love the old, you know, bar music that I could really say what I want to say. But he says, hey, I knew if I could write nice music like Pat Boone or something, and they play me on the radio. And then he wrote songs like School Days and that kind of a thing. So even Chuck Berry knew that there was a certain type of music and song that you would write and that would get played. So, you know, the 50s were really a cool time to kind of see the different things kind of move out and get airplay. I mean, the Alan Freed rock and roll radio really became huge in the 50s. And if you watch the movie slips in my mind, American Graffiti, my gosh. That really gives you a full glimpse of what that whole thing, that whole idea of kids hanging out, cruising, listening to music. I mean, it was huge. I mean, the whole DJ, listening to music with your friends and all this kind of stuff. I mean, that was a whole thing into itself. I remember even back in the 70s, you know, early 70s and even late 70s, there were still, you would still cruise on Saturday night back in San Bernardino. And but they still tried to hang on to that, and it's they outlawed that because people got a little rowdy, so they don't do that anymore. But anyway, just that whole Wolfman Jack and all that type of, you know, huddling around the radio and in your car and all this kind of stuff. It was a pretty interesting time, the 50s. And so let's skip forward to the 60s, which, you know, to me, this is when I wake up. I mean, the 50s were more kind of my mom's. She loved the 50s, you know. That whole style of music. But the 60s, see, that's probably my favorite time. You know, because then you integrate in. And what's interesting is when we start talking about the 60s and you start mentioning The Who, The Stones, The Beatles, they were influenced by blues players of America in much degree. So they were influenced by the blues players, and it went all the way over to England. And then England brought, you know, a little louder blues type of music to us. You know, the Beatles played Little Richard songs. The Beatles played Chuck Berry songs, and they did some covers early on. You know, Led Zeppelin, huge blues influence. So it's interesting that how that something that we already had here in America would be revered so highly in England, and then they would kind of repackage it in such a way. They turn the, you know, they turn the amps to 11. And then they come back over here, and then they just, you know, rock us out. And but anyway, the 60s with the Beatles. The one thing I love about the Beatles is that they were not school professional musicians. They were very experimental musicians. They could play, but they didn't play normally. They had very different tunings. And what was really interesting about George Martin is they would sit down and, you know, they'd say, I want to try this. And George Martin would go, well, we can get a, you know, a small quartet, you know, of, you know, woodwinds or violas or something. And they'd bring him in the studio and they'd do that. You know, John would sit around and I don't know what he was smoking and doing, but anyway, he would say, I want to try this. I want to play my voice backwards. I want to play this backwards. I want to try this. And all the experimental work just really turned music just upside down. And, you know, I think that really kind of set a tone for what can be done. Because for me, my opinion is all the music that had been done pretty much was pretty standard. You either recreated what you heard, you maybe kind of funked it up a little bit, but the Beatles, to me, they just kind of threw out the rule book and said, okay, what sounds good to me? I'm going to tune my guitar a different way. I'm going to play a certain way. I'm going to use a capo, or I'm going to do this and that. I mean, that's incredible to do. Just think about all that. The Beatles could sing, the Beatles could play. And then as things progressed, they finally just said, we're not going to tour anymore. We're just going to make records. And I think some of their later records were just the most incredible music I've ever heard. Now, I want to hold your hand, but, you know, I think their most incredible music they ever created was toward the end when they did not tour and when they just really focused on making music in the studio. I mean, there's some stuff now that you just play that's, like, incredible. Yes, Mr. Dave, go ahead, sir.
Hello?
Yes, sir.
Okay. I would have to agree with virtually everything you said. I think one of the things that helped the Beatles to be as experimental as they were is that, as I recall, none of them ever had any formal music training.
Mm-hmm.
They learned like one or two songs, and then they taught each other, and then they learned from other people that they met. So mm-hmm. they, because they weren't trained, they didn't have the rules that you learn in classes.
Right.
So, I mean, they were breaking rules because they didn't know they existed.
Sure.
And as they progressed, and this is something that I have to say I respect about them, they always tried to do something new and different than everybody else and different than what they had done themselves before. I remember when they came out with the Beatles Anthology video and DVDs, 10 years ago now?
Yeah.
Paul McCartney made the comment of, you know, you can listen to this and you can hear the evolution of the band. I'm like, I don't need the behind the scenes to hear the evolution. Like you said, put I Want to Hold Your Hand up next to Across the Universe.
Mm.
There is just no way those were done on the same album. You can hear the progression of the band through their regular studio albums.
Mm. I think that really should be a testament, I think, to musicians, I think in any age, in any time, is that I think there's a point where, yes, you do need to learn certain chord structures and maybe some music theory, but at some point you just got to say, what sounds good? Let's try this. Let's try that. And I don't know how they pulled it off, because from what I understand, music studios were very expensive back in those days, but somehow they had enough money and George Martin worked for cheap or something, because they did some really incredible stuff, you know, and I think that experimental age really helped a lot of music. You know, we'll talk about Beach Boys in a little bit, but I think it really carried forward just so much. Was there anything you want to add, Colleen, about the Beatles?
No, I mean, I don't think I can add anything. I think you guys are right. I mean, they had something different, and I don't know, I can't quite fathom what made them so unbelievably popular so fast, because their songs were so simple.
Well,
musically, they weren't, oh my goodness, I can't believe somebody did this, but it was that they were just very simple, but they said what they needed to say. I think the words, their lyrics were what really, really made them, I don't know, maybe that's what made them popular. I guess they were cute. It's just that they were so different, and the teens of that era were rebelling against, you know, everything at that point in time.
Now, definitely, I think you're referring to our early Beatles, because as they progressed, they got different.
absolutely. I am talking about in the 60s. I'm talking about them in the 60s. And then when we moved into the late 60s, early 70s, after they started taking substances to help them, I don't know, musically or whatever, things changed drastically.
Yeah. They were done in 1970, but yeah, the late 60s were like, the most creative, you know, and whether it was enhanced or not, I really think it was the best music I'd ever heard. The best music I've ever heard were those later recordings. And you know, it's interesting. I joke a lot, and I say a lot of things that are like funny to me, but they have a grain of truth. And so, you know, I told a guy that, you know, they should have got rid of Ringo and brought back, you know, Pete Best to play the drums or something. Anybody but Ringo Starr. They always gave Ringo, you know, the easy, dumb songs to sing. And he stopped me. He goes, no, let me just ask you one question. He goes, I know what you're trying to say, but let me ask you this question. He goes, you know, a song like Something, what would it have been like without Ringo's drumming, you know? And he goes, think about the songs that you really, really love and take out Ringo's drumming. He said the timing, he had timing that you really don't appreciate. And then I remember I went back and I listened to those songs and I went, all right, you got a point, you know? For whatever reason, that those four, you know, gents really had something. And I think what was really interesting is that when they wrote a love song, you know, whether it was influenced by Maharishi or something they were smoking, that they were not only relevant to the kids at the time, but they also they had a reality to it that maybe they looked at things differently, but you still could listen to the song and relate somehow. It is first of all incredible to record an album and get it to be popular. It is almost impossible to record an album that's popular and it's going to be popular 30 years from that time. If you can do that, well,
going on almost 40 now, and some over 40 in some of those cases,
right,
too.
Sure. So, definitely, the Beatles were musically fantastic. They were instrumentally fantastic, but they also have that charismatic and a creative spark that I don't know that anybody else really can touch. Maybe a couple of bands we'll talk about in a little bit, but they also could sing, you know, and Paul and my God, I mean, they could sing.
Uh-huh.
And there's a lot of people that can't sing today that's selling records.
That are getting paid millions of dollars to be horrible. And it's mind-boggling. But that's for a discussion for, I think, later in the show.
Yeah.
They had a couple other things going for him, too.
Go ahead.
And, well, one was when they first became popular, they came out and they were dressed in suits and they played rock and roll.
Yep.
And up to that point, rock and roll was, you know, still kind of your rebel blue jean crowd.
Mm-hmm.
So they were a band that parents could say, you know, I really don't like the music, but they look like such nice boys. I guess I'll let my kids listen to it.
Right.
They're clean cut.
Yes, exactly. And
sure. Yeah, and they did have the long hair, but they still had that clean cut look about them. That somewhat wholesome image that really was just on the edge of not quite wholesome.
Mm-hmm. And the other thing they had going for them is they came out as a band. They were one of the first groups that was a band. Up to that point, you had Buddy Holly and the Crickets. You had Bill Haley and the Comets. You had, you know, so-and-so and the rest of the band.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
And they came out, and they were the Beatles. It wasn't John Lennon and the Beatles. It wasn't Paul McCartney. It was a group of four guys. You couldn't put any one of them ahead of the other.
Mm-hmm.
Well, okay, Ringo kind of faded into the background, but, you know.
Okay.
And it wasn't even – and here's the thing, I'm going to contradict just a little bit what you're saying, because, yes, you're right. At that point in time or right before they came out, a lot of the bands were so-and-so and the – but you did have your – which we really didn't touch on in the 50s, your doo-wop groups,
right,
that really were the bands. And not one person stood out of any for anything. You had, you know – I'm thinking of, like, the Drifters and, the Imperials, the Belmonts, you know, those guys.
Right.
There wasn't anybody that – I don't think most people could name a singer, you know, a single one of the singers from those bands, from those groups, I should say, because there really weren't bands, because they most of the time didn't even actually play instruments. They really were just singers.
But
it's kind of a little bit different.
And I think what Dave was trying to point out is they were – names, they were their own people, but they were a group. And I think what he was alluding to was that, I mean, somebody was as good as a Buddy Holly, who was great, Jerry and the Pacemakers or whoever, you know, whatever. These people were really great, but, you know, with the Beatles, they all were these named people who were so good that you watched them. But back in the doo-wop days, like you're talking about, I mean, you're right. It was like a group of people singing. And
yeah.
maybe you liked one of their voices, but there wasn't any of them that you really stood out and you went, oh, my gosh, I want to sing baritone just like that guy right there. You know, it's just, yeah. So.
Well, and I'll even go one step further and contradict you again just a little bit, and just because I'm kind of playing it. When the Beatles came out, I don't think they knew them for themselves so much as we do now. I think they were known as the group, and they were known as the members of the group, and they were, you know, the girls, you know, liked their each one differently. I don't know that they necessarily, you know, I don't know if people at first realized that John was a phenomenal, you know, songwriter.
Well, all right.
So, but I think they gained that notoriety very quickly. But I don't know that it was, you know, all it was they were the four lads from England, and that was all anybody ever knew about them when they first were popular, when they first came out on the scene. And I don't think even up until probably maybe right before they split up, I don't think people really recognized George Harrison as much as they did John and Paul, because they were definitely, they wrote most of the songs together, and John sang on a couple, and Paul sang the majority of them. So, I mean,
they were
the forefront.
George was the quiet one. He was the quiet, right. So,
but as time went on, I think they got known, they all four got known for their individual talents.
Yes, they did,
as time went by. But initially, you know, it was, you know, okay, I don't like Ringo because I can't see him behind the drums, but boy, Paul is so cute. Or, you know, there was something different to like about each one of them. So if you didn't like one of the guys, you did like one of the others.
Yeah.
Right? And that, I think, is what helped their popularity. I mean, if they take Buddy Holly and the Crickets, if you didn't like Buddy Holly, then you didn't like anything they did.
Right.
Because there was nobody else that stood out.
Right. You know what's funny, too? Now that you say that, I think that's kind of the thing with the whole doo-wop band or the doo-wop groups from the 50s. Let's think about that. If you even knew who any of the Imperials were, you take out that maybe that lead singer, and they're all just backup singers.
Right.
I mean, yeah, you're not going to idolize necessarily any of them, because without any one of them, they were just, you know, a bunch of backup singers that, you know, they weren't anything special. But boy, you get them all together and singing their songs, and whoa, now you're, you know, the Temptations, you're talking about something completely different. And that, you know, they weren't known as individuals at that point in time, I don't think.
Right.
Okay. Well,
now, with, I'm sorry,
go ahead. Go ahead.
Within the Beatles, what helped drive their popularity was, as much as they looked out for each other, at least in the early days, they also were very competitive with each other.
Hmm.
If John wrote a number one song, Paul had to write a number one song right behind him.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And that drove each of them to try and do more and be better than the others, and try do new and different things. And I think that's why, as a band, they all exceeded their individual talents, because they pushed each other that hard.
Mm. Yeah.
Which makes a whole different dynamic.
And they had George Martin to pull a lot of it off, too. And,
yes.
You know, they said, well, we want to try this. Well, I think we can do that. Let me make a few phone calls, you know, get somebody over there. Chamber music or whatever. Ah.
And then, just to bring this back into the other bands of the time, the Beatles had so much success in the early part of the 60s that you had other school kids of the time saying, hey, they're doing that, I can do that.
Yeah.
And I think the success of the Beatles is what drove other bands to try things, and other bands to even come into existence, which is how you got groups like, well, the Rolling Stones were around right about the same time, but I mean, you see what I mean? Their success kind of drove the other bands to try and do more and be better.
Yeah.
Well, and the Stones were always the rough boys. The Beatles were the clean cut. You know, maybe your mom will put up with maybe an album or two in your room, and you can listen to it, whatever. The Stones came out; they were scrappers. You know, you had poor Keith with his teeth all jacked up, playing Chuck Berry riffs and just tearing it up, you know. But they definitely, you know, were just competing one against each other. And what was nice is, you know, you've got that, you know, Magical Mystery Tour, and then in the Satanic whatever, it was the same type of a album cover. And I think even at that point, they kind of broke off, where the Beatles went more just all over the chart, the Stones went more bluesy and said, now we're just going to hold true to kind of where we started and just conquer that whole blues style, where the Beatles said, we want world music, we want influences from yogis and different things and everything, we want influences from all over, and the Stones said, we just want to be the best blues hard rock band that we can ever be. And, we want to scare parents and have girls run down the front and scream and yell. And
well, because let's face facts. If they hadn't become rock stars, do you think they would have had girls falling all over them? Not so much. But if John, Paul, George, and Ringo had not been so fantastically huge, I think they could have gotten girls pretty easily.
Yeah. Okay.
I know that's on a base level, but anyway.
All right. So definitely... You know, we talk about this for 2 hours. Let's talk about another event that neither these two bands attended, but this event really threw a couple of other bands just right in the stratosphere. That's Monterey Pop Festival. And, you had a guy named Jimi Hendrix playing guitar, left-handed guitar. First of all, left-handed guitar. I mean, it strung the guitar backwards and played the wrong way, and just tore it up. You know, there's famous stories about, you know, Pete Townsend and The Who, also played the Monterey Pop Festival. Pete Townsend talking to Jimi Hendrix, you know, and they're just like, "Oh, you want to go first? No, I'll go first." Well, you know, they're trying to jockey for position, and then. You know, supposedly there was a story about, somebody, talking to Pete and watching Jimmy light the guitar on fire, and he goes, "Does Manny stealing your act?" And Pete goes, "No, he is my act. What are you talking about?" And Jimi Hendrix was just one guy who, again, with this whole Beatle-esque type of learning enough to play the instrument well, but then throwing the rule book out and say, "I'm going to play with my teeth. I'm going to play behind my neck. I'm going to use a wah-wah bar. I'm going to move the guitar and use feedback." I mean, this guy was off the chart. And but he had, the sultriest blues style. He played jazz chords. I mean, this guy was scary. He could reach from any type of genre and play, soft songs like "Hey Joe," or play "Foxy Lady" or "The Star Spangled Banner," whatever. Jimmy was incredible, just fantastic. And what's interesting about him is whether you're a 60s wild child or whether you are a, upper crust person, you like a Jimi Hendrix song. There's at least one that you really like. And that's what's interesting about him. He was a tragic young death, and sad, but, you wonder what he would have done if he would have stuck around. But, in The Who, another British invasion band that came over and just, kind of jockey for position against Jimi Hendrix and The Who. I mean, what a battle royale, but also what's interesting about the Monterey Pop Festival was that Icantina were there, I think. But anyway, it was a lot of these great Stax record artists, Sam and Dave, and this type of just really cool, hip R&B music was just taken over. And the Monterey Pop Festival really just, Mamas and Papas were there. So you had this whole other explosion that was going on as well. And, you can't not talk about Jimmy. But The Who, they made their own. It was that whole reinterpreting of America's music in England. I mean, they always found a way to kind of reinterpret it in a really cool, interesting way, And then there's Led Zeppelin. They have their own, huge stratospheric, and they went from the 60s and the 70s, but, I think it was 69, I think, they came out with. But just that whole, blues reinterpreting, just tearing it up. But then you also have the Beach Boys, which was a whole different type of a sound, and that's another thing. When you start talking about music, we're going to start to kind of talk about, we talk about reinterpreting, but there's also kind of revivals of certain things, like the doo-wop bands of the 50s, doo-wop groups, now come to the Beach Boys. Well, you got Brian Wilson, who is this genius he could think of all this musicality, but then have this way of harmonizing that was scary. I mean, there's a couple of bands that really stand out to me as far as probably the best harmony singing I've ever heard. Mamas and Papas is one. Beach Boys are another. Then you've got Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young. David Crosby. He was in no, it was the Birds. But you've got people that are just so good, they're scary. What are your favorite harmony groups, Saweetie?
Harmony groups from the 60s, are we talking specifically, or just any?
Yeah, 60s.
I'm definitely the Mamas and Papas. I mean, you really can't get much better than the Mamas and Papas. I have to admit, there were a couple bands that I really enjoyed, or a couple groups that I you know, enjoyed some songs from them. I believe it was Paul Revere and the Raiders who did Henry VIII, or was it somebody else?
Herman's Hermits.
Okay. Yeah. That's it. Okay, well, it's Herman's Hermits. That was another song I liked. Granted, that was a slightly different sound, but the Mamas and the Papas, if we're talking about folk singing, which is kind of what I would... They're really not folk singers, though, but...
Right.
What, you know...
Pop,
what
is it pop? English pop.
Yeah. Well, I was actually... Mamas and Papas are not English, but...
Right.
You know, I was going to say, part of what shaped music in the 60s, and probably every decade, if you think about it, but specifically the 60s, just because there was so much that happened in the 60s, the events of the times are what really, you know, world events, what really kind of prompted, you know, folk singers were protesting the war and just trying to, you know, have love and peace and harmony in the world. And, you know, your bands like Janis Joplin and that were, you know, political and raging against, you know, the establishment, that kind of a thing.
Yeah,
I know I kind of got off topic a little bit, but
you're dancing around the name that we have to talk about now is Bob Dylan.
Because you know what? Yeah, I'm not a big Bob Dylan fan, I have to tell you.
Well,
just not.
I think Bob is one of those enigmas where you don't sound good, you don't look good, you kind of don't even play good, but there's something about all the different parts that you put together that people go, that's important and I need to listen to that. And it is a rare thing to find that. And those type of three things that, well, they don't look good, they don't sound good, I don't know, you know, whatever. But he is a fantastic writer. And that's one thing we really didn't talk about. I mean, we can talk all night about the Beatles, but John was a fantastic writer. He had a way with words and writing and, oh, my God. But Dylan was a good writer as well, but he was a cause writer. Songs had meaning, and sometimes the meaning was not in the subject of the song, but it was kind of within the song. And so, you know, long before people studied Lost, you know, they studied Bob Dylan songs and Beatles songs and listened not only for the words, but for the meaning of the words and for the meaning of the song and the musicalness and all that. You know, it was a very deep time, you know, and you could say, well, they all were on drugs. Well, okay, there was a lot of drugs being taken, but I think that the music was deeper than, you know, what you had with a doo-wop band. You know, that's just my opinion. I think the music of the 60s was more important because it was deeper. They were definitely more experimental with everything, with lyrics, with the way things sounded, with the way things were put together. But then Bob Dylan came along and said, okay, not only that, but I have something to say. And I remember, you know, obviously there's, you know, the songs he's famous for, but then I remember when he switched to his electric guitar, and I was listening to a recording, and he was starting to play, and somebody yells out, Judas. Because when he went electric, I mean, a lot of people really felt that he just had sold out. And they were angry because they really loved that whole folk side of Dylan. But when he started playing in the bands with the electric guitar, I mean, it was a huge, huge shock. And so, you know, somebody in the audience yelled out, Judas. And he goes, I don't believe you. You know, this is funny. The guy's, you know, everybody came to see him, and this guy is shouting, you know, Judas, I don't believe you. You know, and it was just kind of one of those funny moments that was captured on recording. You know, just the, you know, an early heckler for Bob, I guess. But
that's funny.
Yeah,
unfortunately, Bob was not the most talented as far as singing,
no.
But he wrote lyrics that just really touched people. And again, a lot of his stuff was protest stuff too.
Mm-hmm. True.
You know how can you say he can't sing? He's one of the best mumblers around.
That's true.
But you touch though on one of the things that I think, you know, like Colleen, I'm not a big Dylan fan,
right.
But I do respect the fact that he was willing to take chances. He turned to the folk guitar before it was truly popular,
yep.
And right at the height of its popularity, he switched to electric.
Mm-hmm.
And then he made a country album when he was supposed to be a folk rock singer.
Yeah.
And even today, he still will continually reinterpret his own music. He'll play it in a different tempo or a different key or just mix it up however he wants to.
Yeah.
To keep it fresh, not just for him, but for his audience.
Right.
And he's willing to take that chance. I mean, how many bands or acts have you gone to see where they play the stuff from their albums, but they play it almost exactly like the album?
Mm.
And you don't necessarily get, you don't know what you're going to get when you go to a Dylan show.
True. I remember when he was touring with Santana, and a lot of people were just like, man, what is going to happen tonight, you know? And, I think that was one of the greatest keys of the 60s that you know, was discovered, is the whole changing it up, never staying the same. It can be the same song, but let's do it differently. Even the same song, you can do it differently. And I think... as a great lesson that they, you know, gave us all. There's one other name I want to talk about, and then we'll move on. It's James Brown. If there was any other man who could dance and perform better than James Brown, I don't know. I don't know who it was. And he had a way of sitting out. Now, he comes from the school of mumbling of Bob Dylan. I think they had the same teacher, because James would talk to the band, and, you know, it's not a joke. I heard a song today. James Brown was talking to the band. Yes, yeah. I don't know what the guy's saying. The band's like, uh-huh, yeah. But, I mean, He, oh my God, he's just incredible.
They even know what he was actually saying?
All they knew, they was getting paid. And so they just, let's take it again from the top. Okay, we're going to, from the top, everybody, you know. But James Brown was incredible. And now we start talking about, you know, okay, the Beatles were concerned and put their celebrity into peace, you know, especially John and Yoko, but I think the band as a whole, they were concerned about the war and they wanted peace in the world. And, I remember the story of James Brown playing a concert. I think it was in Boston. I think there were some riots, and he basically donated his time and his concert to kind of calm the city down. And so we can kind of start to see these types of activities where performers were using their celebrity for good instead of just taking money. And James Brown, just, my God, he, you know, if all you know about James Brown is you know, Rocky IV, shame on you. You know, and if all you know is it's a man's world and Papa's got a brand new bag, shame on you. You should go back and listen to those records, because they were incredible, incredible stuff. Live at the Apollo and oh, man. So James Brown, you know, brought the whole performance aspect, the dancing, the singing, the fantastic, tightest band that you've ever heard in your life. You know, there's stories about how he paid the band you know, and if they missed a cue, because he would, you know, cue them when he was singing, you know, you just look around and, you know, bump, 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 bump. And if they missed it, he goes, I got you. I got you. I got you. You know, and then they'd owe him money for blowing the cue. So incredible stuff. Virtuoso, for sure. So,
and he did it without the benefit of lip syncing, like a lot of them do nowadays.
That is absolutely true. Wow. And you know, as we get to the end of the discussion, it's going to be kind of painfully obvious where we're going to go. But anyway, the 60s were just an incredible time. 70s now. Let's move into the 70s.
We missed a very important genre of the 60s we didn't even talk about.
What's that?
Surf music.
Okay. All right.
There was a big insurgence of surf music in the 60s, you know, with the Beach Boys, Jan and Dean,
and a
bunch of others that, you know, still, even now today, we still love that music. And it makes you feel like summertime. It's all happy and happy. And, oh, Dick Dale, oh, my gosh, one of the best guitar players I've ever heard. So, I appreciate the surf music. I don't listen to all of it, but I do appreciate it.
Mm-hmm. Well, in the Beatles, you know, were impressed with that, with Pet Sounds. You know, they listened to that record pretty intently, and then that influenced them. So kind of like Dave was saying, is that there's a lot of competition, which really gave us some of the most incredible music because, you know, I heard a guy tell me that in the CS and in Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young, that you know, one would play, you know, just a furious solo, and then, you know, Neil Young would say, "Yeah, I'm gonna beat him. I'm gonna play a better solo than him." And so, you know, you have this kind of competition, and you're right. I mean, the Beach Boys came along, you know, when the Beatles were at the top of their game, and all of a sudden, Pet Sound, Brian Wilson's brainchild, Brian Wilson's Beatles album. You know, it, just to call it that, this very experimental, incredible album.
Yeah.
You know, who knew that this guy would come out of nowhere, you know, with this surf music, kind of doo-wop-y kind of, you know, band that would just, you know, be such a huge, huge success. So you're right. You know, I mean, surf music can't say that it wasn't important. It definitely was.
Yeah. I mean, really, in the 50s, it really didn't exist, at least not that I'm aware. And it didn't carry over much into the 70s. It kind of faded. And now, and what I mean is, you didn't see any new groups starting up to, you know, to play surf music.
Right.
And I can't think of any that have been around in the last 20 years. So, I mean, it really had its time in the 60s. And, it's still part of pop culture on some level because let's face it, we turn on the TV or the radio and we hear commercials with, you know, Surfing USA or one of the Beatles, you know, not the Beatles, I'm sorry, one of the Beach Boys tunes playing as their, you know, their whole their commercial. So I mean, we're inundated with it, or Dick Dale or whatever. I mean, and you know, pop culture, Pulp Fiction came out in the 90s and used Miserloo, Dick Dale's version of Miserloo as one of the most seminal pieces of music in the movie. So,
true. I have a trivia question, and I bet Dave knows the answer. Who was the surfer girl that the Beach Boys were singing about?
Oh my gosh, I totally know this too.
I don't know, but my guess would be Annette Funicello.
That is a good guess. That is a very good guess. It was actually Tony Tennille from Captain.
That's right.
Really?
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was Tony Tennille. They knew Tony Tennille growing up with her. And here's the other thing. I don't know her name, but I know the niece of the woman that Fun.
Oh.
We'll have fun till Daddy takes the T-Bird away.
Okay.
A girl I went to high school with, she was a couple years younger. Her aunt is the girl in that song because she was friends with the Beach Boys. She grew up with them in she had a T-Bird, and she got caught sneaking around with the boys once, and Daddy took her T-Bird away until she behaved herself, grounded her from, and so they wrote a song about it.
And I do remember The Who singing a redo of "Help Me, Rhonda." Anyway, one of the Beach Boys songs. So yeah, there was definitely an influence, but yeah, just I threw a little Beach Boys trivia there. That's about it.
That's
about
awesome.
All. Okay, so let's jump into the 70s. You know, we've got "I Will Do My Best Not to Talk About Disco." Disco was there.
Yeah, but Madonna, just, though.
Well, no, I'd rather talk about Led Zeppelin.
Okay, but we got to throw in some talk about disco. I'm sorry, but you're going to have to, because let's face it,
all
it
right.
was very important to the era. You can't leave it out just because you don't like it.
All right, the disco was a Caucasian version of funk. It was a very watered-down funk.
Really?
Yeah.
That's your take of it? Because
yeah.
I get a very different take of it.
It was this dance music that had the soul ripped out of it. It was just, ugh.
No. Here's the thing. If you think about what disco was, disco had a lot of orchestral sounds, which for me is a throwback to the loungy stuff of the 60s, 50s and 60s, but set slightly more upbeat.
Okay.
You're not agreeing with me, obviously.
Nope. That is your opinion. I will let you have it, but I just...
Oh, come on. They used a lot of violins, which was something you didn't have. They used a lot of, very more beefier sounds, trumpets and things like that in their stuff that you didn't...
Well,
and saxophones, things that you weren't getting in, like, the rock stuff. I don't know. It always makes me think of, like, a little more, you know...
Okay. All right. So, I mean, carryover is definitely in part of what we're talking about. So, okay.
Yeah.
Led Zeppelin, another, fantastic band that just stormed in, pulled in all kinds of different elements. They had Led Zeppelin III, had a very acoustic album, and they just crucified them. Because the band had come out with, Good Times, Bad Times, Communication Breakdown and all this, and then, come out with That's the Way and Hats Off to Roy Harper and all these kind of acoustic songs, and people are just, what? And it's funny because, they bring in this whole Middle Eastern type of a sound, and then people would say, well, what's going on with Led Zeppelin? But they forgot about the Beatles, So anyway. Zeppelin, but then Pink Floyd was another type of a very experimental group. A bit pompous for my taste, but then I think rock artists in some degree are pompous. They both feel like this, the world rises and sets on them. I remember watching History of Rock, and at that point when Pink Floyd in the 70s, they were making so much money that they can spend just months in the studio and they can just do whatever they wanted to do. And so, you hear David Gilmour say, he took, 2 weeks to write this guitar solo for Dark Side of the Moon. And, they just took all this time and it was just the most perfect solo in the world. And wow. But anyway, Pink Floyd, we started to kind of move into that whole, it wasn't just a musical group, it was a musical theater group. And they started to kind of pull in lights and different things. And so it was more than just music. It was, they probably had a lot of it in the 60s too, where they'd shine like weird colored gels and have all kind of lights moving around and all this. But I think to me, Pink Floyd was kind of the really big, pretty grand concerts and that kind of a thing. But then, to make up for disco, we can start talking about funk. Now, James Brown kind of set the standard, but then you have groups like Earth, Wind, and Fire, Parliament Funkadelic, that really just got things funky. And Earth, Wind, and Fire, you know, brought the virtuoso of like a James Brown, you know, with the musical, you know, talents of, you know, like a James Brown, a tight, nice, fantastic singing, great harmonies, but also great, just a fantastic band. You just can't, you can't lose with Earth, Wind, and Fire. But then as we move forward, then we get bands like AC/DC, you know, very, again, it was an Australian kind of a turn on its head of blues, you know, definitely a, you know, loud blues. And, you know, I think, you know, with all due respect, I love AC/DC, but I think they only know six chords, and that's really the truth. You know, it's a blues in G or blues in E and blues in A, and that's all they play. But they find a different way to, you know, make the song sound. But anyway, AC/DC, there you go. But then there's one other band that I think really kind of encapsulated the whole thing. We talked about Jimi Hendrix, just a phenomenal guitar player that was just like scary, dropped on Earth from another planet. He was just so good, you didn't even know where he got all the talent from. But then you have Van Halen, which was came on the scene in 1978. You know, you got, they called him the Loud Brothers from Pasadena. You know, you've got Eddie Van Halen, you know, his brother playing the drums. You got Michael Anthony. You've got David Lee Roth. You know, really just kind of took things right through the roof. And, I mean, Eddie Van Halen was so good that just everybody just kind of followed him and tried to play like him. And I think that was really the great thing about the 70s is that it really kind of honed things down to a style that it was so good that, I mean, a band could kind of showcase a guitar player. He was so good, but there was also this band. And I like the whole David Lee Roth era. I know he was misogynistic, and I know all that stuff. But it was a fantastic when Van Halen first came on the scene, they were like a bull in a china shop. They came to destroy the audience. It was just there's no nice way to do it. I mean, he's going to take that guitar and just wail, and that was just all there was to it. You know, David Lee Roth was going to take the ladies. Eddie Van Halen was going to play the guitar, and then they were just going to rock the house. That's all they were going to do. They were just like a rolling circuit. They were just rolling through the town, set up the tent, have fun, and keep on moving. Wow. I mean, that was a great kind of an end to a great era. I mean, in the beginning of the 70s, you had the death of Jimi Hendrix, the breaking up of the Beatles. You know, Janis died in, like, 72. So there's a lot of death and the end of a certain type of an era, and the end of the 70s really kind of opened up for a lot of things. But disco, you know, it had its effect on things. And now we move into my wife's favorite. Yes, sir.
Before we move on into the next decade,
yes,
I have one question that I don't know, maybe one of you can answer. One of the bands out of the 70s that I personally happen to like is the Eagles.
Okay.
And I've read the critics' reviews of them, and pretty much every review I've ever read by any supposed rock critic just trashes them as being the worst thing to happen to music in the 70s. And I don't understand that. I don't understand why they feel that way. Do you? I mean, can you enlighten me? Do you know anything more about this than I do?
Oh, Dave, I think you've had spies watching me. Let me set the stage for you so you understand my opinion and how I come by.
Okay.
My parents were divorced. You know, this isn't going to be an Oprah session here, but that's just the state of fact. I live with my mom much of the time growing up. So, you know, guys have a rebellious streak. And one of the bands my mother loved was the Eagles. Oh, my God. She had every Eagles album they made, even before they were little Eagles. The kids banging on pots and pans in the kitchen. She probably had those albums too. And so, I fought against that, and I just, I think perhaps the critics feel that, I think they missed the whole vibe of what the music was. I get it. I always have really gotten it, is they really wanted to capture the whole California easy kind of a lifestyle. And for me, the music was very slow. It didn't have a whole lot of loudness, but they were trying to capture that type of kind of an easy vibe. And go ahead.
I'm going to interject here for a minute, though, and add to what you're saying. Yes, it was an easy vibe, but they did have a couple of slightly more fast-paced songs.
Right.
What I honestly think is that they were trying to bridge the gap between country and rock.
Okay.
Because they had stuff that was very country-sounding on the basis level of it. And they really did have that kind of a little bit of a twang in some of their stuff. But then they also had a little bit more of a little bit slightly more driving rock in some things. And if you really listen to some of the songs, like specifically Hotel California.
Right.
Not really a country song, but it kind of has a little bit of that twang in the background.
Sure.
But it's not full hardcore rock either. So it's kind of, I think part of why the critics didn't like them so much is because they couldn't pin them into any one category, because all their songs had a blend of kind of almost everything. If you really think about a lot of their stuff, and I'm not a huge fan, but I like the Eagles. There are some songs I really, really enjoy. In fact, I listen to them almost daily, actually. So there are some songs where you kind of go, how would you describe it? Because you can't say it's country. It's not rock. It's not easy. It's kind of like, it's just the Eagles.
Right. And it was a very country rockish feel. Absolutely true.
Yeah.
Now,
but different than your other 70s bands like Alabama, who were hardcore southern rock.
Right. Well, yeah. I think the one thing, Dave, that maybe they have the critics have trouble with is they missed the whole idea that the entire band tried to really play well, and they missed that. They missed that point. And, you sit down, you listen to Glenn Frey. You listen to him talk, and they're like, we spent a lot of time practicing, working on that song to get it right. And I think that's kind of where critics kind of, miss it, is that, they want something to sound good, but they don't realize that even if it doesn't sound a certain way, that it's executed well. And I think that was kind of my quandary with the Eagles, was I wanted to be kind of raucous and loud. I mean, you give me Victim of Love and you give me Life in the Fast Lane and I'm happy. Those two are probably my favorite songs that the Eagles do. But even like Tequila Sunrise, if you listen to that song, you listen to, whatever else, that there is a virtuosity in them that I think a lot of people miss. So,
One of These Nights, New Kid in Town. And see, that's, again, here's the other thing I was thinking. Did they really have a whole lot of, scandal or anything interesting about them? I know the one big thing that was like, and it was Hotel California album, if I'm not mistaken, where everyone just freaked out thinking they were Satan worshipers.
Yeah.
And
yes.
I think that colored everything, because I remember that there was big talk about, well, if you look at the album and you look at the hotel and there's one window, you look in there, that's the leader of the satanic cult. And I'm like, are you even remotely kidding me? That's just ridiculous is what that is. So I think that was part of what I think probably tainted them for the critics, is that somebody made up some, you know, rumor, and the critics took it to the extreme, and it was like, eh. And they brushed them off as being, well, they're, you know, they won't last, and eh.
Well, kind of in conclusion to what we're talking about, I will say maybe that the Eagles weren't understood because they probably represented California, and maybe people in other areas just didn't get it. So that's all I can really kind of say, I guess.
Yeah. Now, before you head into the whole 80s thing, you're missing another big part of the
70s. Did we do any help for you at all, Dave?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, you did. Thank you.
Okay, good.
What I was going to say about the 70s, the other thing you missed from the 70s was we missed the whole, what I would call the bubblegum pop kind
okay.
of stuff.
Okay, yeah. Well,
Donny and Marie, the Carpenter.
Now, okay, these are, okay, well, we'll throw in bubblegum music. Bay City Rollers, Leif Garrett, Donny Marie, Bobby Sherman, on and on and on.
David Cassidy,
the Partridge Family, the Brady Kids, you know, I mean, we just keep on going. You know, so, all right. Now the 80s. Now I let my wife take over from here. I'll mention one thing and then I'll step out of the way and I'll let my wife take over. U2, the most awesome band ever, period. The 80s and beyond. Okay, go ahead, honey.
Didn't I actually kind of record something in the late 70s, 78, 79? But they really didn't make anything until, you know, make it big until the 80s. Anyway.
I think it was 80, but anyway, go ahead.
Yeah. Well, in the 80s, let's see. Well, as everybody kind of knows, you started off with a little more there were a lot of different genres in the 80s. And
right.
What's funny is that most everybody just automatically goes to the one. You say 80s, and most people, I would say, the band they always think of in the 80s is Duran Duran.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there's nothing wrong with Duran Duran. I love Duran Duran. I've always loved Duran Duran, but part of that is because John Taylor is beautiful. Yeah. I wanted to marry John Taylor when I was in high school.
Okay.
But they were really actually very talented. They were pretty to look at, and they were very talented, and they had a new sound. It's something very different. 80s saw kind of the dropping off of disco. The beginning of the decade saw that, you know, disco just was dying, and country kind of made a little, you know, comeback. Even big band started to make a little comeback with some of the stuff that was coming on, and it was very much it was kind of like a, well, let's go back to our roots, or let's go back and look at something. And then you had like the new wave stuff and alternative that kind of came into play.
Okay, let me register this, and then we'll get right back to it. That MTV changed everything, and
yeah,
I don't know if it changed it for a good reason. And we'll talk about another resurgence of another type of MTV-ish thing. Anyway, as we go, but MTV made faces out of voices, and that kind of changed the playing field. There was a great example of, I remember in the late 70s, probably in the early 80s, maybe probably late 70s, whatever. No, early 80s. Christopher Cross was huge. I mean, this guy was massive. I mean, Laura's Theme and Sailing and all this kind of stuff. He wasn't a good looking chap. And he, you know, he probably did not like his picture taken a lot. So when MTV came along, all these acts that really didn't look all that well but actually sounded good, they kind of faded away, and Christopher Cross was one of them. It really reminded me of the early films where people who had a lousy voice, when it went from silent films to talkies, they went away. Either that or they dubbed their voice somehow. They had to do some kind of trick. But That's what happened in the MTV days. And so that's why we had to look elsewhere for people, because, I mean, there's a lot of, you know, kind of long hair people, whatever. And then, you know, you get Duran Duran's like, oh, well, okay, there is he on the ice. Okay, the girls like him. Let's go. Let's pull in a George Michael. Let's get Duran Duran. There we go. You know, so, but anyway, MTV had a huge influence. Okay.
I think it had an even bigger influence. I mean, I'm just a year or two younger than you, Jeff. And I remember when MTV came out and people stopped talking about, hey, I just heard this great song. And it became, I just saw this great song.
Yep.
And people stopped talking about the quality of the music in terms of the music and started talking about it in terms of the music and the video.
Mm-hmm.
And
the video. Have you seen the video for da 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 da? And it's like
exactly. Mm-hmm. No, and I enjoy Duran Duran. I think they're fun to listen to, but you know, they became popular because of the videos, not because of the music.
Right.
Right.
It's absolutely true. I was in San Bernardino at the early MTV days, and I remember radio was just adamant. You know, we didn't talk about the punk really, but anyway.
That's what I was exactly thinking is that, you know, at the beginning, from a carryover from the 70s, which we didn't talk about at that point, but was punk, you know, and punk.
Ramones, The Clash.
Yeah.
Beatles, I mean, yeah, just, yeah. But even radio in the early 80s, you know, you call up, you know, can you play the Pistols? No, we ain't playing that. Oh, well, can you play Duran Duran? No, that's a video band. We're not playing that. You know, it's like, well, you know, what are you going to play? So we're going to play, you know, whatever. And so there was – radio was afraid of video. And you know, you're right, Dave, that the whole mindset changed. And I remember there were bands like The Babies. They were huge with John Waite. But when, you know, MTV came along, they just kind of faded out because – they didn't have any videos and nobody had money for that. And they're like, our music is good, but you know, we don't have videos. And so that's why you have people like, that director who did that stupid Batman movie. They did, he did a lot of the early, Duran Duran, videos, and they shot them in, you know, Barbados or whatever, just gorgeous background.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
You don't mean Joel Schumacher, do you?
Joel Schumacher. That's right. That's right.
I didn't know he directed the Duran Duran videos.
I'm pretty certain he did. One glance at a Wikipedia, I'll tell you for sure. But yeah, he was one of those early directors that actually, you know, was, you know, hard up for work at that point. So, you know.
Well, I'll tell you one video I know for sure he did direct, Joel Schumacher, was The Devil Inside by INXS.
Okay.
He definitely, that is something I can vouch for. But I don't know about Duran Duran's stuff.
I think he, yep. Let's see, wait. Okay.
He also did Smashing Pumpkins, but that's the 90s. We won't go there yet.
Right.
Did him one of the music videos.
We might not get to the 90s.
No, I'm sorry. Russell Mulcahy. That's the guy. Sorry.
Oh, okay. But right. Here's the thing. And speaking of, and we'll kind of gloss over because let's face it, the 80s is, you know, there's so many different genres in the 80s, and a lot of it was really, really good. And I think part of what you really love and appreciate about music is what was popular for you when you were in either junior high and or high school. So for me, you know, mid to late 80s, that was all, you know, that was high school for me. And so actually, I was dead center of the 80s. And, you know, so the music that was popular at that time, that's what I really, really love and appreciate probably more than anything else.
Well, I think you've hit on a huge, huge aspect. And I think that, you know, trying not to be gauche here, but you know, when you fogged up the back window and the music was playing, that's what you'll always remember. And so, you know, boys and girls or boys and people in love and stuff and music, it's all, that's what you remember.
Honestly,
so,
if you think about it, hormonally speaking, that's
right.
What drives you.
Yeah.
And it's true because some of my favorite music happens to have been from the era when I was, you know, probably the most hormonal as
there
a teenager.
Go.
You know, the love songs, even then it was like, you know, and the fantasy about the guys. Another popular thing, I was going to say about the video thing, is videos did become so incredibly huge that you had people like Diane Keaton directing videos.
Right.
I mean, that's a big deal. That's a big deal.
That was 90s, though. You're talking about Belinda Carlisle's video, you know?
Yeah. Was that early? It would have been early 90s then if it was, but...
Okay, it was probably late 80s, I'm sorry. But,
I was thinking 89.
You're right, yeah, okay.
I was going to say is, you know, you had a carryover from punk from the 70s, you had the new wave alternative stuff, which is like your Duran Duran type band, and then you also had the beginnings of rap.
Right.
And it really wasn't super popular, but you had that. You had old school. I had one in my head, too, just a minute ago. I was like, oh, my gosh, I can't believe I forgot that this even was popular in the 80s.
Double Dust and, you know, Furious Five and all that. And then you had Run DMC.
Yep.
You know, and you started to kind of see that type of music really start to take hold. Now,
yeah.
Me...
But then let's also not... What?
No, I love that whole progression. And what was funny is the earlier stuff was kind of cheesy because they were just trying to find their way. But then you have a band like Public Enemy, NWA, that just come and kick the door down. That's when music really got... rap and that type of style really got important when they really started to say something. And just like we were talking about before with whether it's Bob Dylan, whether it's the Pistols talking about how bad life was in England, when music starts to say something, that's when it really becomes important. And it also becomes dangerous because all these bands that we were just talking about got a point where they really start to tick people off. And, you know, whether it was, Ice-T or NWA or whatever, there's a point where things got dangerous with these artists. And but you're right. I mean, rap had a huge, huge influx in the 80s. And
more so than not. The other type I was thinking that really, before we segue into the 90s or anything like that, is the other one I was thinking is the other genre that was really, really popular towards the mid to late 80s, at least as far as my attention was concerned, was what I call glam rock.
Right. Yeah.
Your hair band.
Warrant, Poison, Rat. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, Twisted Sister. Even though they weren't anything to look at, but you had, you know, that kind of a feel, and It was very different, and I remember back then thinking, that's just horrible. I can't believe anybody would listen to Guns N' Roses. In fact, I used to tease my sister because she would listen to a lot of those bands. And I used to tease her and say, what are you listening to Nuns and Moses for? I mean, it was just, I hated that stuff.
Okay, let's not blend them all together. Hair bands, I think, is completely different from, I wouldn't consider Guns N' Roses a hair band, but... That's just my opinion.
And the only reason I do is because they had that same look that everybody else had. And that same screeching, loud, shouting,
Axl
must not sing.
Okay, fair enough.
Axl must cannot sing. He just, he does not have a good voice.
Right.
He screams, so.
I just hope Slash takes a shower now, because he didn't look like he took many showers. Poor guy.
Yeah, last time I saw him, he didn't look like he had either.
So,
again, he fits the mold of the hair band. I mean, yes, okay, there's the what I'd consider the pretty hair band, and then there's the ones that were just, they had that look just because, you know, we got to rebel against everything. So if long hair is considered, you know, obnoxious, then we're going to have long hair. what was the point, you know?
Right.
Because I really honestly wouldn't lump them in with what I would consider good rock bands of that era, which would be Bon Jovi, because he could actually sing. And he looks pretty good, too.
Well, all right. Okay, there's a couple of other bands I definitely want to talk about. And one is real quirky, and the other I have a huge affinity for, and I'm glad they came around. The first one is V-52s. They kind of led the whole really quirky style of musicality. And they were a very interesting, different band. And, you know, whatever you think of whatever, you still listen to a song like Rock Lobster, and it's just, that's an incredible song. I mean.
Yeah, but wasn't that really, didn't they kind of start out as punk anyway? And they just kind of evolved into something slightly more mainstream?
Yeah, yeah. I think that a lot of bands do that, though. They start off because they're different. But then, you know, either they can't create something, you know, that's different or whatever enough, and then, you know, and then they have to kind of go mainstream to pay the bills. That's just my opinion. But another one is the Go-Go's, which, you know, an all-female band. They came in there and just tore it up. I mean, they were great. And you know, that was a whole other genre of music, you know. Bangles, I guess, to a degree, whatever. But just, I think the Go-Go's were fantastic because, you know, in a way, they kind of did what the Eagles did, is that they captured a vibe of, you know, Pasadena. The Go-Go's captured that Pasadena, L.A., that type of a thing at that moment in time. And, you know, we should also mention the whole Rodney on the Rock, K-Rock. That guy was huge. He discovered a bunch of bands. And it was funny because, I mean, there were English bands and the Go-Go's and different things and Van Halen and all this stuff. I mean, Rodney on the Rock really had a lot of influence in music. And I think it was fantastic what he did. I mean, he really had an ear and an eye for really cool stuff. So, you know, thanks, Rodney, you know. Got to give him props.
Yeah, and also Richard Blade, too. I mean, Richard Blade was pretty popular. That was, like, a big deal. Another band we really didn't talk about very much that was extremely popular in the 80s is Oingo Boingo.
Right. True.
Very, very different, very, but unbelievably talented. You know, I mean, Danny Elfman is truly one of the most gifted musicians ever, in my opinion. And not just because he's a good guitar player, but because he's such a phenomenal score writer and composer. It's just unbelievable, his talent. So
he was a throwback to kind of what we're talking about the Beatles and all that, is that he was involved in some band that he, like, had to handwrite music for it. And so he basically kind of created it as he wanted to, which, you know, again, that's very, very Beatlesque. Okay, we got to kind of hop because I want to get to the end. So, because we have like 30 minutes, and so I want to have enough time to talk about music today. But all right, so we have the 90s, which, you know, I think it was, you know, the 80s without, you know, any nice dress and pretty this and pretty that. It was all pretty grungy. A lot of it was really grungy. I think, you know, probably the best thing was really some cool R&B with, you know, the different female R&B bands and that kind of thing. I mean, you know, you had, you know, Jodeci and that kind of a thing going on. But on the other aspect of things, you had Nirvana, which, you know, they changed everything. They brought in that whole Seattle sound that hey, Jeff, ICITV man, what's happening? We're talking about the 90s now. We're just talking about Nirvana. So, but yeah, just I remember the first, you know, Yeah, I'm not trying to overstate anything, but I think the first time you heard Smells Like Teen Spirit was, I'm not trying to make anything bad, but I mean, it's like when somebody landed on the moon. I think I remember when I heard that song for the first time. And that changed music. So, you know, and I know, you know, that wasn't your style, but, you know, man, that was incredible stuff. So, Nirvana, Soundgarden, Pearl Jam, you know, just all of that. It was great. You know, I remember I kind of liked Nirvana and Pearl Jam. I liked okay, but when I heard Soundgarden, I was done. I was like, okay, okay, I'm interested now in this grunge stuff. Okay, gotta check it out. First time I heard Black Hole Sun, it just kind of rearranged my whole mind. Yes, Mr. Boshin, sir.
I have to say, at some point in my life, late in college, right after college, I got to a point where I hated commercials on the radio, and I hated the DJs that thought they were funny and weren't.
Mm-hmm.
So I stopped listening to the radio, and I strictly listened to music that I had at home. And I would, you know, I'd make my own tapes and listen to that in the car. So a lot of the stuff from the 90s, I'm honestly not familiar with, but the 90s to me, I don't see any one band, with the possible exception of a Nirvana or maybe a couple others that you mentioned. I don't see any one band really dominating the decade or any style dominating the decade. It's kind of a blank decade to me. You know, and again, maybe it's because I didn't listen to the radio as much, but nothing stands out.
Yeah. Well, you actually bring up a really good point, because I think there is a lot of us, even before CDs and before CD players in the car, that we had kind of shifted over to cassettes and, you know, mixtapes that we kind of made at our home. But, you know, to me, the first time I heard Black Hole Sun, I just went, wow, that's something. You know, Alice in Chains, to some degree, it was pretty cool, pretty different. But I think I needed that at that point. I had a marriage that was failing, and so, you know, maybe it was kind of recapturing youth. Or something, but I don't know, Chris Cornell, the only man I know that could sing two different ways well, the low register and the high kind of screaming thing. I don't know, man. He just, wow. I don't like the new album very much. That first album he did, Euphoria Morning, was just off the charts incredible. But anyway, 90s grunge, I think was good. But it was like a car, you know, running on gas. It had sugar in it. It had a clock tick, and you knew it couldn't last forever, you know. And so we went from the 80s with, you know, the gold lamé jackets for ABC and all these kind of things, and we went to the 90s. With the Pearl Jam and the Blue Jeans, that wouldn't accept any awards and wouldn't, you know, say anything. You know, they just kind of, you know, I don't even acknowledge this award ceremony and all this kind of stuff. So, I mean, it was just their way to kind of, you know, make a statement, probably a lot like Marlon Brando did, you know, years before, about the American Indians and, you know, that kind of, you know, whatever statements were important at that point. But I love some of the grunge, boy. And then Nine Inch Nails came along, which really was interesting type of different music. You know, and I joke a lot and I go, it was just, I wish this guy would cheer up, you know. But he was, Trent Reznor was an electronica guy that was kind of channeling the old The Cure, that type of a really sad, melancholy type of a thing. just with loud electronic music and just loud music. I think Nine Inch Nails are very important at that point, because there was kind of this swath of people that were really, you know, it's funny, back in the days of like Sabbath, who we didn't talk about, they were speaking out against how bad things were, and they wanted to make scary music, you know, and I think Nine Inch Nails were also trying to kind of tap into that type of feeling of, you know, maybe the negative side of things, and also Smashing Pumpkins, you know, to some degree, but Smashing Pumpkins were a great musical band. I mean, that when I heard Zero for the first time, I was like, wow, that just that whole guitar riff when he bent that string, because at that point I was learning guitar, and I never finished learning how to play lead. I could play rhythm okay, but just watching somebody study Billy Corgan's guitar playing, and also the Asian guy that played guitar as well in that band, and explain how he did it. I was just like amazed that somebody would, oh my gosh. The 90s to me were the 80s to Colleen. I really kind of woke up to music in the 90s. I had a great, great musical time in the 90s. And then, you know, you have Metallica, which was, you know, Zeppelin through the roof. I mean, they were just loud, just heavy, fast, and knocking people out music. And they look like awful, man. You know, just long hair and big old bushy, blech, you know, but they could play some music. I think the last thing in the 90s I want to talk about is Tupac. Now, Tupac, I think, was, you know, NWA, Public Enemy, in a suaver way. He could really say something and then kind of give you that smile, and you look at him, you go, well, he's not such a bad-looking guy, and, yeah, you know, maybe he's not so bad, but he'll tell you what's happening. He'll tell you what's going down and how bad things are. He's a very interesting character. And, you know, another one who died, you know, too young. But let's talk about the 2000s. Anybody?
Well, before you do, one other thing that kind of another genre that kind of gained a little more popularity in the 90s was electronica. A lot of dance music.
Right.
You had just, you know.
Erasure and that kind of thing?
Erasure, yeah. But then you had, like, I was thinking of, like, Kathy Dennis. Little Miss Queen of the dance music, you know, that kind of stuff. So CNC Music Factory, step
yeah.
pop, electronic dance type stuff. So
yeah,
that was another thing that kind of really, especially at the beginning of the decade, was really, really popular.
Mr. Jeff, sir?
Howdy, howdy.
Hey, how you doing, man?
Hey, I am dialed in, so if it sounds better, that's a reason.
It does.
Hey, you know, you mentioned electronica, but that goes back to 1976, Herbie Hancock. Mm-hmm. I love his stuff.
Yeah.
The funk, the psychedelic, but I also like the techno dance.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, a lot of it sounds all the same. But you know, I thought it was interesting, you know, your bulletin on MySpace about Marilyn Manson, a rock star. The
right.
shock rock type of artists, just like the shock DJs that are out there, like Howard Stern or whatever.
Yeah.
I don't
yeah.
know what the attraction is, where they sing about hatred and rhetoric and anti-God or whatever, regardless of, you know, your religious affiliation or whatnot. I think they just try to offend as many people as they can.
Yeah, yeah.
And there's a white rap star that's very popular, and I do not understand it.
Yeah.
You know, I don't want to mention names because I'm friends.
Sure.
I have a mutual friend
mm-hmm.
who's friends with him, but they kind of said the same thing that, yeah, he just has a good marketing team behind him.
Well, and I think the key is it's been in the bag of tricks for a long time, where you try and offend the parents and the kids will love you. And so there,
yeah.
I mean, that's been a trick forever. Even in the Beatles, in some way, they came out originally and they were like, oh, they're okay. Yeah, I want to hold your hand and da 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 da. And then as they, move forward, then it's just like, what? Sexy Sadie, what's going on here? What?
Yeah,
hey,
Wake Up Little Susie, another one.
Yeah, let's spend the night together. What? What's the Stones at? What's going on? So, it's been a trick, and we'll kind of wind up talking about Marilyn a little bit, but let's kind of roll through the 2000s. We have just a little bit of time, but we're almost there. Talk about Rage Against the Machine. This is cause rock, man. It's like Bob Dylan, with a big, huge, loud electric band, but then you have Radiohead, who really take musicalness in a very artful tone. To me, I'm probably overstating things, but to me, Radiohead, in a way, is the Beatles of today, is that they're very thoughtful in what they do. And, maybe it's not exactly the same, but to me, it's that same type of feeling where you can listen to a song and it's like a certain CDs that'll grow on you. Soundgarden did it for me. I listened to a song and I liked it. And let's do another song, and it was like, yeah. And then I heard it again, and I went, I like that song. Those are CDs that you just, or albums or whatever, that really get into your bones. They things that you kind of grow into liking. That's an incredible gift if somebody has that with a band. We're gonna kind of go all over the place. There's Eminem, which is probably kind of halfway mentioned.
We'll figure it out. That's what I was talking about. But.
Yeah. Whether it is a trick to get money or whatever, he really caused a huge, huge, big ruckus. And I think it was to just kind of tick everybody off.
Well, and then there was 50 Cent, who he's been shot like 12 times. He's almost invincible.
Right.
Funny backstory, someone asked my wife to send the image of 50 Cent to her. She didn't know who he was, so she scanned a picture of a U.S. 50 Cent piece. So I always tease her, honey, see this guy named Curtis, black guy? His name is 50 Cent.
I think it was, I did a comedy bit about a guy named 250 or something there, because I'm three times.
It was 250.
Yeah,
that's
like
funny because like networking
eight
world
times
that I'm involved in, there's a technology called FDDI, FDDI.
Okay.
So hey, can I borrow 50 cents for the vending machine? No, it's on the FDDI network.
Okay.
Stuff like that.
In
2002, the 2000s, Trans Siberian Orchestra, even though they're kind of a electronic band, they look like hard rockers.
Yeah.
But they're amazing.
Yeah.
Well,
really good.
And that's kind of another thing is we've definitely talked about melding of different things. I mean, I kind of didn't want to talk about the whole Limp Bizkit type of thing where you blend rock and rap. But I mean, that's all there.
They're considered new metal.
Right. And you're taking two different styles and blending them together. I mean, that's all out there on the table.
Right.
The term nerdcore.
Right.
There's a band in California that's really good friends of ours called the Switchblade Kittens, and there's a plug for them.
Mm-hmm.
They have songs about Harry Potter, and now there's over 200 bands that are themed around Harry Potter.
Wow.
But if you were to see this band in public, you'd like, they have Harry Potter songs? Because everybody has a cat name, and their primary instrument is a bass. The basses are programmed to sound like a piano, a keyboard, a drum machine.
Mm.
Wow. And what's this band called?
Switchblade Kittens. They're based out of L.A.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, you have, let's face it, in the 90s, you have hip-hop, which you kind of talked about with the Eminem, and Ice Cube, Outkast, Kanye, 50 Cent. Mm-hmm. You got R&B, which is very popular, with Justin Timberlake and Beyonce and Alicia Keys and Usher. And then you have rock. And then, but then within rock, there's so many different genres, like the new metal we were talking about with Limp Bizkit, and then pop punk, which would be like Sum 41, Good Charlotte, Green Day.
Seeing to me, Stray Cats was punk for their time.
Yeah.
But they were in a totally different genre. It'd be like Europop.
Yeah.
Let me toss out two names, and then we'll wrap it up. This has been a very interesting show, and I got to thank Mr. Dave for giving his 12 cents, because I think he gave more than two, but it was cool. Now, okay, Evanescence, which is the type of emo, rock, you know, whatever, kind of coming in. One more thing is I remember listening, or I was watching the, the Grammy show, and I remember Sam Jackson coming out and saying, you know, sometimes music is music, and sometimes music is funky. Let's get funky. And this band came out and just tore the stage up. It was Robert Randolph and the Family. This guy came out with a Hawaiian flat guitar that was like an electric guitar, and that guy tore that thing up. And so what I'm saying is there's all these blendings of different things and reemergence of different music. The end of what I'm saying is that a few weeks back I saw on Rolling Stone it said Marilyn Manson rock star. And I'm like, are you kidding me? Are you kidding? After all this music that we've talked about tonight, after all these great bands, you know, the Beatles, U2, Duran Duran, whatever, all these bands, now all we have is Marilyn Manson? Are you kidding me? That guy's just made up, saying whatever he wants to say, just tick people off. That's
Please
not
tell
a rock.
You mentioned Kiss at least once during your show.
Okay. No, I didn't mention Kiss, but okay. There you go. Kiss and O'Glam and all this kind of stuff.
The funny thing is, really, truly, how many people talk about Marilyn Manson?
Well,
only those that don't like him.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know anybody who likes him at all, number one. And number two, I don't hear his music anywhere. Of course, I don't really listen to the radio much anymore. I'm listening
to most of his stuff
can't
be played on the radio because he doesn't want to make a radio edit version of it.
Right.
Right,
okay.
Which is fine. But, I mean, I don't even listen to the radio anymore because, and that's a whole other show, which is XM satellite radio. So,
right.
But there are so many other bands out there that really, and other, you know, there's a lot more music out there now. And I mean, we can't narrow it down to is Marilyn Manson all we have? No.
Well,
oh my
there's
God.
Two words that will save music, and that is indie bands.
There you go.
Independent bands kick butt because they are piss poor, but they want to share their work.
Right.
And with the Internet Equality Act, if you've ever been reading about all this stuff, it's crazy, but I've had indie bands approach me saying, oh, you'll play our stuff?
Mm-hmm.
I'm just a podcaster, you know?
Right.
And I don't have a legal battle to deal with. If an indie band says, hey, here's my promo CD, and here's the written agreement that you can play it for without capital gain,
mm-hmm.
by doing that with some of the big labels, no
yeah.
way.
I just think that stuff like American Idol and, you know, has really kind of watered things down, you know, to the point where it's all about looks and, you know, it's not much about talent. It's about how much do you weigh? How pretty are you? You know, do you look cool? Okay.
And I'm going to disagree for the very reason that Kelly Clarkson is not a size zero little model girl. She's cute, but she's not super thin. She's got a nice figure. She's not got a great figure, but she's got a nice figure. Ruben Studdard, I'm talking American Idol. You bring it up,
right.
Ruben, I'm going to throw down.
Right.
American Idol, right. Hold on. American Idol, you've got Ruben Studdard. Ruben Studdard is a big man. Even after he lost a bunch of weight, he's still a big man. Ruben has a great voice. Kelly Clarkson has a great voice. You have Jordan Sparks, who just won this year. She's got a great voice, but she's also not the thinnest girl around. You
right.
have some of the top five of the last season. It was not about the looks. So that is not a true statement. And, by the way, American Idol didn't water anything down. They just changed the playing field for people and allowed people who weren't, you know, groomed for this stuff necessarily to come into it and
well,
have
think,
a taste of the pie.
I think Snoop is trying to say that the American Idol type of shows that are trying to wrap it up, that this is reality when it's not, because there's a lot of talented people out there that just don't make it because of their looks. And yeah, there are exceptions to that rule.
Yeah.
Because there are some talented people that have a good marketing people behind them, and that's unfortunate. That's what it takes to get up off the ground.
Okay. We have 4 minutes. This has been a fantastic show. But I'm going to wrap it up like this.
You have to do a follow-up, Jeff.
Okay. But what I'm going to say is this. If you have anything to add, if you're listening to this right now and you have something to add, something that you disagree with, something that you agree with, please email roniezone@gmail.com. Also, please leave your feedback at talk.roniezone.com. Also, visit our website at roniezone.com. We will pick this up at some point. And we will get to the end game for this. I thank everybody for being here. I thank Mr. Dave Boshin, Mr. Jeff Norris, my lovely wife, and all you folks that are listening and not calling in. Thank you for being here, and we will do this again very soon. And take care, and see you later.
See ya.
See ya.